2212.
Are those headphones okay?
Headphones are perfect.
Yeah, they're lovely. Yeah.
Okay.
I love a headphone when I'm recording a podcast.
Do you? Yeah, it just makes it very legit.
Hello and welcome along to the Good Glow podcast today on a Thursday. Thank you so much for tuning in. So I wanted to release this podcast today because today is the day that Mark Megan releases his book. And this interview is so amazing that it deserved its own moment. So thank you so much for tuning in. And I really hope you're going to enjoy it. So Mark Megan, lots of you will know him. He's a comedian, writer and podcaster. And when I heard that Mark was releasing a book, I couldn't wait to get my hands on it. So when it arrived through my door, I remember opening the first page and just wanting to get a sense of what the book was about. And I couldn't believe the first words. They were, "My name is Mark and I am an alcoholic. You could probably also call me a drug addict." When I read those words, I remember thinking, this book is going to be so honest. And from then, I couldn't put it down. So Mark in the book, he says his second language is chaos. He spent much of his 20s battling an alcohol and cocaine addiction. His early 20s, he spent working in the music industry as a songwriter before moving to London and landing a job at the BBC. But in 2020, Mark returned home full time when he finally started trying to get sober. He got himself on the right path, and when he did quit alcohol and drugs, his career took off and he met his beautiful fiance, Dhiren Garahy. This book is Mark through and through, so much so his voice is literally coming off the pages. So much respect and admiration for Mark for writing something so honest and so incredible. He should be eternally proud. This book is going to put the wind in his sails. It's called This Is Not a Self-Help Book. Pick it up this weekend and I hope you enjoy this chat. As always, I've left important phone numbers in the show notes. And just before we get into this week's episode, I wanted to say thanks to Yoplait Skier for supporting the Good Glow this season. At Yoplait, quality is their passion and their commitment to health and nutrition starts with the sourcing of ingredients. Three core values, pleasure, simplicity and joy, help Yoplait deliver healthy, delicious and nutritious pots of enjoyment to their customers. So let's talk about Skyr, a great nutritious yogurt. Skyr is a creamy Icelandic recipe. Like Greek yogurt, it's packed full of protein, fat-free, and Yoplait Skyr has only one ingredient, milk. I personally love their big pots, and Skyr Natural 850 gram is available across Aldi stores nationwide. And great news, it's now available in Super Value too. Mark Megan, welcome to the Good Glow podcast.
Georgie Crawford, how are you?
I'm so happy to be here with you. I feel like I've been watching you over the last couple of years. I was hoping one day the time would come that we get to sit down and have a chat. And then I got sent your book in the post and I read it in almost one day.
Wow.
So congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Do you think so?
Genuinely love it.
I really appreciate that. Like I said to you before we started recording, you know, it's so strange, the concept for me, like this whole like talking about, you know, a very, very challenging time in my life. But sincerely, it feels the imposter syndrome is real. Do you know what I mean?
So it was my birthday and Jamie birthday. Booked me into Espa up in Paris Court.
Lovely.
And
is that an ad now? Or? Is that gifted just because?
This is not the roast of the Good Glow, Mark.
Someone call the ASAI immediately. Let's go.
So anyway, I went up and I don't usually at the moment get much time to myself. And yeah. I was like, oh, I'll bring Mark's book. And I literally felt like you were following me around Espa. So the relaxation room, the reception, like this book, as I was reading it, is your voice. I feel like you were literally reading it to me and I could not put it down. So much so that I arrived very late back to my house. Jamie was holding down the fort, but I said to him, I was like, I was reading Mark's book and I just could not put it down. And I've gone back over the last few days and had to flick through it again. But I suppose my first question for you is, who has read this in your life?
That's a very good question. And thank you again. Like it's weird and bizarre hearing nice words about something that you put so much into. You know, it's almost more relieving than rewarding. But who has heard it so far? Like my family have read it, you know. Darren has of course read it, and people in the publishers. That's it. I haven't sent it out to that many people.
What did your mum think?
Yeah, I was terrified sending it to my mum and to any of my family members, because I almost felt like, oh God, A, you don't want to write something that's just this like complete distortion of reality and like, oh, woe is me. And, you know, everybody has their own version of reality, right? Yeah. And I didn't want to write something that then they'd all of a sudden go, holy shit, is that what was going on all those years and we didn't realise, or, you know, anything like that. So my mum read it and she said it was brilliant. And she said, of course, it was parts of it were really hard to read, but none of it like surprised her.
Okay.
You know, which was a relief for me, to be honest.
Yeah, because I really relate to what you're saying there about writing a book, because you're like, do I think that now? Did I think that then? Have I learned that since this experience? It's really hard to figure out actually what was my truth and my reality back then.
Yeah.
Such a good point. So when I was reading this, I was like, oh, whoa. It is so honest.
Yeah. I hope that's a good thing. But I suppose, like, for me, I had a choice when I started writing this. It was a case of, do you want to write something that you think is going to sound nice and read nice? Or are you going to write the truth? Because there is a difference. And I, for instance, like, I've always been one to talk about mental health and to try and talk about the uglier elements of mental health, because I believe the way that, generally speaking, it's discussed still is way too sanitized, right? Everyone wants to have a conversation around depression, you know, and they want to hear a good story of maybe somebody getting through depression, but they don't necessarily want to discuss like the uglier aspects of other mental health issues, right? And I'll lower myself off my high horse here for a second, but I suppose I just wanted to make sure that I didn't write something that would alienate anybody experiencing the things that I experience, whereas it's like, no, if you actually show the uglier sides of you, I think there's a better chance of somebody out there relating.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it does. It makes complete sense, because I was like, I don't know if there is a more honest book that I've read. Like, I thought, and not that I thought I knew you, but, you know, I'm familiar with your Instagram. I listen to your stuff. I've watched your journey from a couple of years ago to where you are now, and the building of your career, which has been amazing. I hope you felt that support. Like, I thought I knew you, but I have actually no idea about your life. I thought, oh yeah, Mark says, and I know that you say this in it, like people are, it's like people don't take you seriously as an alcoholic, or some people didn't, because they think that was just something you did now, and then you're fixed now. Surely you could have one or two drinks.
Yeah. The goalposts kept shifting in my own life with my own problems. You know, I'd say, okay, I'll stop drinking if I spend all my money. Bang, I did that. But then I'd say, well, I actually had to spend my money, because, you know, there'll always be an excuse. And then I'd say, well, I'll stop drinking when this happens or when that happens. For years, I didn't get help, because I was like, well, I work in the BBC, you know, I live in London, I'm doing okay. I mean, I'm broke every week, but that's all circumstantial. That's just because I'm not being paid enough. That's just blah, blah, blah. I suppose I don't know what I was waiting for, what sort of rock bottom I was waiting to happen before I actually stopped. And that never came. And I think with that applies to, by the way, so many aspects of my life, where I'm waiting for something to get so, so bad that someone's going to intervene and go, Mark, you need to stop this now, and we're going to put you on a different path. That doesn't happen. I've had people do that. I've had relationships where the person said to me, you're an alcoholic, this has to stop. But in the moment I go, she's controlling. She won't let me live my life. If only you had the problems that I had, you would drink. If only you were so fucking tortured. Like, that's the delusion, unfortunately, of addiction. But I found myself asking, like, in the months I stopped drinking, you know, what is an alcoholic? Like, what makes me an alcoholic? You can obviously quantify it by, you know, how much I drank. But then as time goes on, I realized, like, it's very much a spiritual condition. It's just alarming how many people there probably are out there who are dealing with an issue, be it alcohol related, be it in a relationship, be it work, be it the relationship one has with their self, could be their weight, anything. And they're waiting for something to, there's this like imaginary line that they feel is going to be crossed one time. And that's then when a reset will happen. But that can just continue getting pushed out forever and ever and ever. And that's what I did for my entire 20s.
Yeah, like till until the very end, until it takes everything from you.
Until it takes everything. And, you know, more often than not, until it's too late, until the damage has been done.
It was when Mark moved to Brighton after his leaving cert that he started drinking alone. 8 cans of Foster's a night, an attempt to ease his loneliness. In the book, he speaks about putting on a front, feeling like he existed on the outskirts, and he drank, he says, in an attempt to put the fire out.
You spoke in the book that, like, as soon as you were out of the leaving cert, you were gone.
Yeah.
Over to Brighton, where you could almost play the role of this other person, and you were telling people at home one thing and coming home and everything's great. And then just the experiences you had, when you think about that, you were 18.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. And when I was writing the book, part of me was like, holy shit, you were so young. Me moving to Brighton, there's a term that like people in recovery might use, is which is called pulling a geography, right? So like, I grew up in Dublin. Obviously, I grew up in a very, very lovely family, lovely background. You know, I never wanted for anything. I was completely looked after. I was loved and I was treated well. I was sent to the best schools and all the rest. But in my head, I could never settle. There was always had to be something else. There had to be something more just around the corner. And I became convinced in my teenage years that like Dublin was the problem. It was Ireland. It was the Irish people. I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be around cool, like-minded, intelligent, artsy people, you know, the most indulgent stuff ever. So I do cringe when I think back about the way I looked at the world when I was 18. But, you know, I became convinced that moving out of Dublin would be the answer to all my prayers. And then I went to Brighton, and lo and behold, all those sort of wankers that existed in Dublin apparently existed in Brighton as well. And I found myself in the exact same scenario. And that just began, that was my life for 10 years afterwards. It pulling these geographies where I would blame my shortcomings and my drinking to excess on the surroundings. It's because of the people around me. It's because of the job. It's because of the girlfriend. It's because of the career. It's because of the lack of career. It's because of the... there's any reason. And then I would go to a place and I would try and start again. And for the first few weeks, it would be fine. And as somebody once said, you know, it's the gradual unraveling of my life. And that best defines my relationship with alcohol. It's the gradual unraveling. It's slow. If I go out drinking today, okay, I'm not going to have 2 bottles of vodka and end up in a jail cell. If I go out drinking today, well, actually, I wouldn't want to put it to test because I'm pretty nervous this week. So I felt like, you know, hold me a seat down in Store Street. But as in, I would always, when I went to a new place, I would always be able to just about coast it for a few weeks until the really bad stuff started happening. So I'd go to Brighton and I'd be drinking lots and I'd have lots of friends, and then I'd burn through the friendships because I was just a selfish dickhead. I'd burn through relationships. The work stuff wouldn't happen. So many opportunities would come my way, but I'd just throw them away, all because of recklessness and going out in the piss. But then I blame, oh, it's Brighton. These people don't understand. I need to go to London. London's where I'll be understood. That's the place. And then you go to London, you start working there. And for the first few weeks, things are going great. You're meeting people, you're connecting with people, and you're like, great, I've arrived. This is fantastic. And then I start drinking.
But like, there are so many incredible opportunities that were still happening to you because of your talent during the absolute thick of it. So, you know, the job in the BBC, working with Mark Feely in LA, or was it New York?
Yeah, both, yeah.
And, you know, all of these amazing things, like your talent was pulling you through, but then it was the self-sabotage that...
Yeah, that big, big red button, the self-destruct button that sort of just hovers right there.
You know the way you were saying there that it was always the city's fault or that person's fault, or... did you believe that or did you tell yourself that?
That's a good question. I think I told myself that. Okay. I mean, yeah, when I moved to Brighton at 18, I went to the NHS for my drinking.
Yeah.
And that was the first time. And I went in and the guy was like, how often are you drinking? I was like, I'm drinking every night. How much are you drinking? I'm drinking 8 cans of beer, I think. 8 to 10 cans, what I get from the corner shop. Just like in my little student flat, I'd be on my laptop, and it was again, oh, I'm making music, so I'm just, you know, inspiration,
creative,
the class,
yeah.
Like, I mean, the cringe is unbelievable. But I went to the NHS and the doctor said, right, well, like, we need to address this. And, you know, I was experiencing lots of panic attacks at the time, and I was very, very lonely, but I was far too proud to admit to my family or to my friends back home that I was lonely. I was crippled with anxiety and loneliness, but anytime the phone would ring, it'd be, yeah, no, I'm great. I just had a meeting with, you know, Janet Jackson's cousin's gardener, so I'm probably going to have a Grammy by Christmas. Do you know what I mean? just this insane innate desire and need and instinct to just please people and to appear like I'm doing okay and to spin these plates. So when I said to the doctor in the NHS, I was like, do you think I'm an alcoholic? And he was like, well, I don't think you're an alcoholic like yet, but I think you're very much, you know, you're on the line. And I walked out of there. I was like, I'm not an alcoholic yet. Let's go. And I went drinking that night. And again, it like therein, for instance, lies the flaw for me. I just wanted somebody else to come in and, oh, here you are, Mark. This is your problem. And here's the solution.
Yeah.
Whereas eventually, until I reached that point of just complete and utter personal surrender of like, I don't want to be here anymore. I don't want to be me anymore. I'm forfeiting my sort of passport to life as Mark. I've done it wrong. And I can't do this anymore. I simply can't. I will stand in my head in the corner of the room for 5 hours a day if that's going to help me not drink. Because I'm sick of it, and I'm sick and tired of myself more than anything else.
Wow.
After Brighton, Mark moved back to Dublin, but in 2015 he was on the move again, this time to London, in an attempt to escape his partying. But as he says in the book, no matter where I went in the world, I would always bring my head with me. It was London where he started to do hard drugs, and his hangovers evolved from slightly inconvenient little headaches into fully fledged miniature nervous breakdowns. But he managed to get a job in the BBC, and so far was managing to hide his addictions from his work colleagues.
When you say there about loneliness, and you know, in all life coaching and health coaching and all this, they're like, treat the cause, not the symptom. So the symptom is drinking and drugs, yeah. And the cause, have not to put words in your mouth, what do you think the cause was?
I think it's a question I'll be asking every, you know, for the rest of my life. But you could be here forever trying to isolate certain reasons as to why I'm an alcoholic. I do not have the same trauma that many do. But any alcoholic that I know from talking to them, it is literally a spirit. It sounds ridiculous. And I'm sorry for isolating people who aren't alcoholics, who may not understand what I'm talking about. But it's literally something that's just in you from when you were born. I think it stems from my relationship with myself, or lack thereof. There's like a disconnect between me and myself, wherein I am not happy to just be Mark. And I am not enough. It's a lack of acceptance of both Mark, but also of the world that I inhabit. And when I drank, my shoulders dropped and relaxed. That was that's my Radox, as David Brent would say, but like that was my sedative. When I had two drinks, everything just felt all right. Those emails that were drive me crazy, that's fine. Oh, the landlord that's on to me about the rent, that's fine. The money that I borrowed from the friend for the bag on the weekend, that's fine. Everything is okay. Those first 2 to 4 drinks genuinely helped ease me into life, where I was like, yes, things are actually grand. Mm. Things are fine.
Because you were numb.
Exactly. But the problem is I never stopped with the two drinks. My mind, when I'm out for dinner with Darren, we're getting married this year, I can go, oh my God, I can't believe I'm going to get married and I can't walk out and have a glass of champagne with my wife on the day of our wedding. Do I think that today? No. Because okay. I would be mourning something that never even happened. You know, I see my friends at Christmas and great for the lads' Christmas dinner. And I can go in, you know, get all misty eyed on the drive home, be like, oh, you know, I should have been able to go in and just have 4 pints and go home. I never went and had 4 pints and went home.
Yeah.
So the fantasy of alcoholism is both in the drinking, but then also I'm mourning these things that never even occurred. Do you know what I mean?
Wow, that is unbelievable insight.
Like, I would have gone to that Christmas dinner and I would have been like not interested in hearing about my friend who's just had a baby, because I'd be like, he's boring the fucking ear off me about this baby. I just want to get the bag. It is self-centeredness is at the root of all my problems. I would have gone to those Christmas dinners when I was drinking and just bundled through the door. Look at what I'm doing. Mark, Mark, Mark. Throwing judgments out at everybody else, waiting until I can, you know, move on to somewhere else, the place around the corner, this place is shit, let's keep going, until it's 9 a.m. and everybody else is gone and I'm sitting across the table from one person who I picked up along the way.
Yeah.
And they finally say that horrendous phrase, I think I'm going to call it.
Mm.
And the sun is up and I'm out and I'm waiting for a taxi and I'm praying nobody I know walks by, and then I go back and I lie in my bed and I stare at the ceiling for hours on end, literally pulling at my hair, going, please let me sleep. But I can't, because there's so many substances in my body.
So when people say to you, oh, could you not just go out and have two? it's like the lads' Christmas lunch wouldn't be that experience. You wouldn't have the wedding.
No,
you wouldn't have the partner. You wouldn't have that life. You would be sitting in some pub that you know, just some random pub with some random person that you'd never met before.
And you'd, by the way, be revealing the most intimate details of your life to a complete stranger. And then waking up the next day, hideously embarrassed about the things that you've said or done.
Can you forgive yourself?
Yeah, you have to. You have to practice the forgiveness. But you also, forgiveness comes with living differently.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? It's all well and good to sit around and pontificate and say, oh, well, look, I was, you know, whatever. Everybody has their own shit.
Yeah.
And being an alcoholic, and particularly being a recovering alcoholic, that does not merit canonization. Do you know what I mean? I'm not a better person than you, you know, because I'm a recovering alcoholic and I stopped drinking. And I think it's really important for people to remember, like, in the end, I stopped drinking because that was the easier thing to do. I didn't, you know, I stopped drinking because it was that, or it was the worst outcome. Because that's where it brought me. It got me to that crossroads. So me stopping drinking was easier than doing the other thing. And like, as a result, I think sometimes people, like, and it's amazing how supportive people are of being in recovery. But like, I do all of these things in recovery just to try and be like a normal person, you know?
Yeah.
But I suppose also there is no normal. And as well, the longer away I am, which is still not that long, but the way that I am from a drink, I realize that I wasn't the only person dealing with shit. And you know, there's such, I think what I talk, I try and talk about this in the book, it's like being in your 20s, I think, is really, really, really hard. And I think if you're single for a long time in your 20s and your 30s, that can be really hard. And there's so much comparisons going on forever. You know, and it's such a classic, but compare and despair. I spent my life inside my head thinking everybody else had their shit together. Everybody else was sorted. Though everybody else was walking to that Christmas dinner and they were going home to sit beside the stove like the Sylvanian family. Do you know what I mean? And it's a fallacy. Everybody has their own shit. Like, this isn't something that I've done and I'm over and I'm through. This is just my everyday. It's just something I do every day to just hopefully be okay. It's not, I do this every day to be more virtuous than the every person. It's no. I do these little things, my recovery habits to make life just livable so I can do nice things and I can also be there for there and I can be there for my family. I can just be a person, a decent, honest, functioning member of society.
What are recovery habits? I've never even heard of them.
Meditation is huge.
Okay.
Prayer is a big one. You know, to whom or to what or to anything is irrelevant. It's more just the behavior, the ritual. Practicing gratitude. I mean, gratitude for me is everything.
And also just to say that you are an incredible storyteller and your ability to paint a picture is amazing with your words. And that's why I think also the book is so good. But you spoke about a girl in London who texts you the morning after a date.
Yeah.
And that, for me, stopped me in my tracks when I read that.
Mm. Yeah, like, I never had any real relationships, really. Towards the latter half of my 20s, you know, I was just completely motivated by self. Dating is just an alternative. As you get older in your 20s, you want companionship that isn't your friends. So you just go on a dating app and you arrange a date and you're not even really arsed, so you're not even bothered by the person, but you just do it because it feels like it's something you should do. So I was doing that all the time and it was an excuse to get pissed. And also on a first date, like, I used to always be this guy, oh, how could anyone have a bad first date, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'd be doing shots and it would be all chaos and entertaining chaos, but chaos nonetheless. And I used to always be like, yeah, one hit wonder, no second date. It's like, how many times are they asking for a second date, Mark? Do you know what I mean? You know that this is like a sort of reciprocal, they're supposed to be in. So I was, yeah, one of the many first dates that resulted in nothing. I went out and it was the same old, same old. It was a Sunday afternoon. I'd worked the next day and I woke up. I'd been on a 4-day binge and I was just, you know, when I'd wake up sometimes from those binges, I would just have a choice and it would be, okay, do I sit inside the confinements of my head for the day and not leave my room, or do I just try and get out and drink? And that day, like most days, I chose the latter and I just went drinking. So I was going through and just, you know, trying to see who would meet me. And I met this lady and we went for drinks. And yeah, it was the usual chaos. We just sat in a bar in Hammersmith and just got hammered. Brilliant. That wasn't even a joke. But, you know, we just got really drunk and I woke up the next day late for work, chaos. And the thing is, like, what goes up, it will eventually come down. And then all of a sudden it's like Monday would arrive. And I've been on the piss at this stage since Wednesday. And, you know, a couple of sleepless nights thrown in there and all the rest. Anyway, and I was texting my friend, I think, at the time, being like, oh yeah, that girl, you know, she's probably too intense, probably really into me or whatever. And then I got a text from her and she just goes something along the lines of like, hey, listen, I know we were only on one date and like, you don't owe me any explanation or anything, but if you, I just hope you're okay. And if you need to talk about anything at any stage, I can be here for you. And I was like, block, delete.
Nope. Really?
Nope. No time. Don't like that. Don't like being seen. Don't like being seen. I'm okay to do the big entertaining bullshit, the bravado, the nonsense, the showmanship. I don't like anybody actually seeing, you know, this is back then. As somebody once said to me, which I thought, I nearly fell off my chair when he said it. He talked about his relationships whenever he wasn't in recovery. And he said, I'd hold you so close so you couldn't see me.
Wow.
People are good. My perception of the world, and I still have to fight this perception, by the way, is that people aren't good or people aren't kind. People are, like, people generally speaking want the best for you. Like, coming on this podcast, writing a book, you know, these are things that, like, every instinct, every, like, you know, learned, shall I say, behavior that I have from secondary school is telling me it's embarrassing, it's pathetic, it's ugly. There's a line in a movie called Barney's Version with Paul Giamatti, my second favorite actor of all time.
Second favorite.
Yeah, first favorite is Philip Seymour Hoffman. So, genuinely. It's like, have you ever seen that? This is my second favorite daughter. I think it's Gene Hackman in The Royal Tenenbaums. But there's a movie in Barney's Version, and it's a beautiful film, heart wrenching. But anyway, Paul Giamatti's estranged partner in it looks at him and she says, you know what your problem is? You wear your heart in your sleeve. Now put it away. It's disgusting to look at. And that's what my feeling is about, you know, being honest and being vulnerable.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast so far. A big thanks to Yoplait Skyr for supporting the Good Glow this season. I love quality ingredients when it comes to my food, and lots of you will know that I am most happy in the kitchen. So how did I use Skyr this week? Well, when it comes to making a curry that my entire family will enjoy, yogurt is my secret ingredient. This week I added Skyr to my tikka masala paste and the results are absolutely delicious. We love this recipe and we use it time and time again. Head over to thegoodglow.ie for the recipe, and don't forget you can pick up an 850 gram tub of Skyr Natural in Aldi, and great news, it's now available in Super Value too. So back to Mark. In 2020, he left the BBC to pursue comedy full time. But within 6 months, he was back in Dublin. Still drinking, he would sneak empty wine bottles out of his apartment wrapped in towels so his roommates wouldn't hear the clinking. His rock bottom moment came in October 2021 when he called a drug dealer to his cousin's wedding. The next morning at 9 a.m, as he cried hysterically at the end of his bed with his sister, Mark said something just snapped in his brain and life as he knew it was over. After all of those years of running, it was when he was with the people that he loved the most in the world that he could see he was meant for more. And that was the first day of the rest of his life.
Do you know what actually is just coming to me now? And I don't want to give away too much of the book. Like, there's a lot about kind of, we spoke about the cause, treat the symptom, not the cause. No, treat the cause, not the symptom. So there's a lot about like school and kind of where things might have come from you. But you speak about the then and now, or the before and after. And it seems like your transition into the now happened actually, now that I think about it, when you were surrounded by your family. So you had gone on so many adventures by yourself. So Brighton, London, you know, hiding. And then it seems like the breakthrough came for you when you were with your family.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's the sort of the beautiful and oftentimes the most frustrating thing about being around family is that when you are, they just reduce you to being your 14-year-old self. Do you know what I mean? Like, every single Christmas, I'm like, this year, I'm not going to get angry at a single person. I'm going to be a fucking adult about things. Within 5 minutes, I'm like on the phone going, oh, you won't believe the comment that's just been made about the T-shirt I'm wearing. You know, I was around family. That was the last weekend I drank, which is strange. And it's sad in a way, because it was also one of my cousin's weddings. And I feel desperate for her because it was such a beautiful wedding experience. And I mean, that's why it's almost like the iceberg thing, wherein people didn't see what was going on. And I was a master of deception and keeping everybody, compartmentalizing, I think is the word.
Yeah.
I had toxic friends that I was keeping there. And by the way, nothing wrong with them, but in terms of me and my relationship with people, and I had all these people around me boxed off, but making sure that the paths never crossed.
That's exhausting.
The most common attribute I think of a recovering alcoholic is fatigue. From just like, I am so tired, and I am so tired still from all of the stuff that happened in my 20s, and just from running and running and running, and the plate spinning and the lies and the keeping the show on the road, and no, it's fine. And then, pushing things, go to a therapist, go to a doctor, GP's office, head in my hands. What do I do? Need to stop drinking. What will I do? Yeah, stop drinking. Okay, I'll do it for a week. Bang, back in the train to London. Everything's fine. A week in the job. All good. Let's have a drink. Let's go. 2 weeks back in the bag, back to the parties, gone. Before I stopped drinking, right? I sent an email in October. COVID came, and that just like left me rudderless. That just took the legs from beneath me, as it did many people. But like my mental health and my drinking just completely spiraled. And it was weird because it happened at a time when my podcast was really performing very well. So I was getting all of this like attention online and messages every day, but I'd nowhere to go with all of that like ego basically.
Yeah.
So I just sat at my kitchen table and drank myself into oblivion. But I remember at one particular juncture, a very good friend of mine, Neil, who was managing me at the time, like he rang me up one day and he was like, you need to stop drinking. He didn't put any labels on it, but he was like, you need to stop drinking, because the show stopped. The podcast was called The Sunday Roast, and it just stopped. And I'd be dropping off for weeks on end, and then coming back and making all these big promises and then disappearing for a month and all the rest. And it was all because of my drinking and drug use. And he was like, you need to stop drinking, that's it. If you want to have a career here, if you want to have a life, you can't, these two things can't coexist. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? You mm-hmm. can't have the way that you want your life to be and alcohol, choose one. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Stop drinking. I incidentally, I got a big sponsorship deal at the time with an alcohol brand. And I was even sending him jokes in my kitchen, be like, oh, imagine if I started drinking. That's how stupid I was back then. That's how reckless I was as well mm-hmm. with myself mm-hmm. and with other people. And then 7 weeks went by, the show was flying, sober, running around, telling everyone I'm sober. And I was just sitting at my desk one day and got a text from one of the lads going, do you fancy a pint at Bull's Bridge? Yeah, of course I do, because I'm better now. I've done this. I've proved that I'm not an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like my entire life was just a series of failed attempts of proving to myself that I'm not an alcoholic. And even when I finally did stop drinking, I'm like, am I really an alcoholic? Normal people don't spend the last 15 years proving to themselves whether they are or they aren't. But sorry, so to give you an example, so I started drinking then, right, on that day. And Neil texted me the next day and was like, how are you? What's the story? And I was like, good, yeah. And then I sort of tried to, I sent a message, but like sent some information, then included the fact that I was drinking, then some information, sort of tried to sandwich it between, mundanities. And he was like, are you joking me? And I was like, no, it's fine. And he was like, you said you weren't drinking. And he just kept repeating things that I had said to him and like replying to the quotes in the message from me saying, I will never take a drink again, all this stuff. And the blockers went off with him, gone. One of my closest friends, because he called me out.
Yeah.
Then things got really bad. Mental health got really, really, really bad. And then went to the GP. Yeah, I'm done. Came home, emailed somebody in recovery and said like, hi, I don't know how any of this works, but I think I might need to get myself into treatment or, blah, blah, blah. Got an email back. I'd have to look at the date, but I'm pretty sure it was like September or October of 2020. And I got an email back. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. We'd love to talk to you. But within the 20 minutes it took for them to email me back, I decided in my head, I'll just have a few drinks tonight. Mm-hmm. Bang, I lost another year. Just another year gone. Like, that's why this whole thing of like me, the illusion of me ever being able to go for two or three drinks has to be smashed by me on a daily basis. Yeah. Because those two or three drinks, fair enough, on today they mightn't kill me, but they will take everything else.
It's amazing that you have that understanding though of your situation.
In making great change, and it's something that like me and Darren discuss all the time, but it's so simple. Like, if nothing changes, nothing changes. Yeah. And in order for me to stop drinking, I couldn't do it my own way, because I'd done that. I had several attempts at getting sober myself
mm-hmm.
for about 3 years. Basically from around 2018 I was trying to get sober, and it was 21 when I stopped. And that was like self-imposed bans and, you know, rules and rationing and beers and wines and, you know, not spirits and, you know, blah, 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 Coke once a month and all the rest. The only thing was when I gave up and said, right, I will do something else. I will take instruction.
So the time then it changed for you is when you did something different.
Yeah. The time I think it worked was when I just said, right, I'm done. The gift of desperation. Holding my hands up in the air and saying, right.
Was that at the wedding?
It was, yeah. I woke up in the wedding. I got to bed at 6:50 and I stayed lying in bed, staring at the ceiling until 9 a.m. And then I woke up, you know, or got up and my sister woke up, rather. And I just sat at the end of the bed. Done. It was like a collapse of everything that had been building up for the last 10 years.
And ever since that day, has your life been better or did it get worse to get better?
My life began the moment I stopped drinking.
Okay.
And yeah, there have been challenges. Like, I was under the illusion that once I put the drink down, that life would just be all roses. And as you say, it's about the cause, not the symptom. And I need to treat my alcoholism by, you know, engaging in a program, in a recovery program, talking to other alcoholics. If I just stopped drinking, and I would have done 3 weeks. So my life is, it's night and day. It's like, very often spoken about, it's like looking at things with a new set of glasses, you know. It's not what I thought it would be.
Yeah.
Sobriety for me was like, in my head, was winning half marathons. I was doing Ironman and it was, you know, just having a satisfied mind. But it's very, very different to that.
Yeah.
But it's different in the most beautiful way. Like, for me now, to be able to sit at home and, like, the other night I was out walking with Darren and Bertie, like, literally walking in Castleknock, not even Dunleary, by the way.
Wow.
Like, you know, we're just walking through and we're having a chat about the wedding and, like, looking at the sky and just go, like, oh my God, this is my life.
Yeah.
Where I'm happy to be here today.
Oh.
I'm happy to be Mark. I'm happy to be chatting, walking with the person that I love and the dog. Do you know what I mean? And just, like, this is enough. Nothing has ever been enough, but this is enough. And, like, that is something, it's profound in a way no amount of books will ever be able to articulate. And as I said, you know, the way that I looked at the world and just all of these rules about how I should behave and how I should be, it's about, like, what I talk about in that book is, like, it's about smashing that.
There's so many layers to it, because you said, like, throughout the whole book, the theme is, like, your loneliness. It's almost like you looked at the world and you were like, it's too boring for me. So you didn't want to belong. And yeah. Now you're in society, you're in the world, and it's like you've gone from black and white to colour, because yeah. Everything you thought about being a normal person in inverted commas,
yeah.
Which you detested,
yeah, yeah,
has made you happier than anything.
Yeah, I know. I'm basic, basically. That's it. I've got the old Marc Jacobs tote bag here and the Veja runner is ready to go. Yeah, that's it exactly. And I mean, it's so much easier to drink. It's so much easier to sit back and tell everybody else where they're going wrong.
Mm.
Without ever just looking, as you know, beneath, lifting up the hood and looking at myself and going, is Mark okay? Like, I would argue that I have laughed for the first time in recovery. I laugh now in a way that I laughed as a child. Do you know what I mean?
It's, yeah.
It's quite ratty and it's annoying, but, but you know, it's a genuine laugh. It's not sneering.
Yeah.
And it's not masking. It's like actual, I find something funny. There's so many cliches and there's so many just like sound bites that sound like they're sort of contrived, but sobriety delivers everything that alcohol promised. Alcohol promised me connection. Alcohol promised me meaning, purpose, a sense of my place in the world, belonging, love. Sobriety has given me all of those things, real connection, real relationships, honest relationships, you know, actual love. I had no perception of what love is like prior to meeting Darren, like. But, you know, I had absolutely no perception of what it's like to be in a relationship and to be of service to other people, to stop being such a fucking neurotic mess, just wrapped up in your own shit all the time. Now, I know part and parcel, like, that's just comes with being in your 20s as well. We're all sort of consumed by self and in this era of, you know, no attention spans and Instagram and everything. But, like, giving up alcohol, it's like, Jesus, wake up. Not in a sheeple anti-vaxxer way, but you know what I mean? Just like a wake up sheeple, but like just actually being present.
Yeah.
It's unsedated. It's life on life's terms. And it's not always good. Today is a good day. Like today, like I looked at myself in the mirror this morning and I could do that. Which even that in itself, being able to look at myself in the mirror and go, this is okay. I'm going in to talk about the book, which is a little bit nerve-wracking. It's a bit, you know, it makes me uncomfortable, makes me want to retreat, it makes me want to withdraw. You know, my instinct is like, oh, well, Georgie's probably going to, you know, oh, what she might say, you know, because that's all fear, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's all bullshit. And it's all just like, I have to condition myself out of looking at the world like that.
Yeah.
And the way you do that is by coming on, by being honest.
Yeah. And then now you can see, and you see it from the world that everyone is rooting for you.
Mm.
And this book is absolutely brilliant. For anyone listening to this podcast, you bust a load of myths at the end, which I think is really helpful. If anyone is even sober curious or just has any sort of anxiety or fears, it's not just about alcohol. Pick up this book, pick up two, give it to a friend. Mark, this is going to be a bestseller.
Thank you. I'm so
happy for you. I'm also moved and emotional at your honesty. And I'm so happy that you're basically basic now.
Well, listen, Georgie, thank you so much. I mean this sincerely. Thank you for having me on, but also thank you for being gentle and being, you know, being very supportive throughout not just this, but you've given me shout outs from about 3 years now and just being, well, 2 years or whatever. And you've just been so sound and kind. So thank you so much.
I genuinely love people that make me laugh, and you've made me laugh from the start. You made me laugh during this book, and I'm so glad that you have met someone who I know genuinely makes you laugh. Mm. Because Dearon is one of the funniest people around. So
second funniest.
She's my second favorite comedian after you, Mark.
Exactly.
But thank you so much. Best of luck for everything. I'm so excited for you going forward, and best of luck with the launch.
Thanks, Mel.
Thank you so much for tuning in today, and a massive thanks to Mark for that beautiful interview. This Is Not a Self-Help Book is out now, and I have left a link in the episode show notes. So we are off to New York City today to run the half marathon with Team Good Glow. We are so excited. We have 150 runners this year. There's 180 of us descending on the Big Apple this weekend to have the most incredible experience together. And we are about to launch our Chicago half marathon and 5 kilometer trip in September, the best time of year to visit Chicago. And Chicago is just wow. If you want to join us for that trip to run either a half marathon or a 5 kilometer, all you have to do is get yourself on our mailing list. And of course, I will leave that link in the show notes too.